Just how autobiographical is Catlin Moran's first novel? The author will join us from London to tell us about How to Build a Girl.
So that's what I've done with my new novel. Kind of, it's about a fat, gobby, working-class teenage girl who becomes a music journalist at the age of 17 and then goes and sleeps with a lot of people in London.
Why is abortion still so controversial? Katha Pollitt will talk to us about her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights.
Although we don't like to think of it that way, the aim of the anti-abortion movement really is to criminalize abortion under every circumstance.
John Williams will join me to talk about what's going on this week in the book world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Catlin Moran has a new novel, How to Build a Girl, and we are talking to her from Manchester. Hi, Catlin.
Hello, my darling. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Good. How are you?
Cold. I'm sitting outside an industrial estate where we're shooting my TV show. And it's not very glamorous. Everything you always think about show business being glamorous is being proven thoroughly wrong at the moment. I'm standing between a smoking kiosk and a Ford Fiesta.
So you're doing a sitcom. You've got a stand-up comedy tour. You have a weekly column in the Times of London. And now you have this new novel. Do you sleep?
Well, you've missed out some stuff in the list. I have two columns a week in the Times, and I'm writing two films at the moment as well. So the answer is no. I don't sleep at all. I barely remember what it feels like. But you know, there's coffee. And, you know, there's determination, and I'm here to avenge my peasant stock against the posh media of Britain. So, you know, that keeps you on your toes.
So your novel, this is a semi-autobiographical novel. Is that a fair description?
Yes, no, definitely. It's kind of the slice of fiction to nonfiction is basically the same ratio as Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House on the Prairie. Like, Laura Ingalls Wilder was a pioneer girl, you know, and she sort of rode across North America with Ma and Pa. But if you look back at kind of like the notes that her daughter, who was also her editor, made, a lot of the things that happened in those books didn't actually happen to Laura Ingalls Wilder. They happened to friends that she had, or they were things that she'd researched, and she sort of made them then happen to the character of Laura. So that's what I've done with my new novel. Kind of, it's about a fat, gobby, working-class teenage girl who becomes a music journalist at the age of 17 and then goes and sleeps with a lot of people in London. And, you know, although that's pretty much my biography, a lot of the individual sexes that happen in the novel didn't happen to me. They happened to friends.
There must be a certain kind of freedom in that, and that you can sort of change things from your real life that could have been better or more interesting had they happened differently.
It's the dream. I mean, it's what kind of, you know, fantasists and liars and sort of, you know, tale spinners do anyway. You know, whenever I'm telling a story about something that's happened in my life to some friends in the pub, you always exaggerate it by 30% and then kind of make up a funnier ending to it. And, you know, and I've realized that's basically what fiction is. I'm sure there are people studying what fiction is at university who would have a more technical explanation. But for me, it's that you can just make stuff up and lie.
And it's okay. Your last book, How to Be a Woman, was, of course, nonfiction. How did you go from writing that to writing this novel?
Oh, it felt really easy, to be honest, like kind of, because I started off writing novels. Like, the first book, I wrote my first book when I was 15 and it was published when I was 16. So I'd started off writing novels. And then I kind of suddenly got to like sort of like 35 and went, how have I not written any more novels? Kind of, a lot of it was because I was making quite a lot of marijuana in my early 20s and then had two children. And those three things will stop you from writing novels. But now I've got a bit more time on my hands because the kids are older and I've managed to not marijuana on the head. It seemed relatively easy to go back to writing books. I kind of, you know, as a child, we didn't go to school. I was taught at home. And I just used to go to the library every day and read at least one book a day. And so after a while, it feels like a kind of digestive process. You kind of read novels, they go in, and then it just feels like some novels will come back out again.
One of your daughters is about the same age as your protagonist at the beginning of the book. Did you think of your daughter when you were writing this book, of thinking of she's going to read it, or thinking of the sort of the way your protagonist thinks at that age? Did it bring you closer to that sort of mindset?
Well, not her specifically, because she's made it very, very clear in her beautiful and polite and well-brought-up way that she has absolutely no interest in what I read, and indeed is what I write, and indeed is horrified by what I write. I recently left her to be babysat by one of my brothers, Joe, and I came back and he was teaching her to play poker, which tells you what kind of babysitter he is. And she was desperate not to lose her hand. And I was like, why are you so desperate not to lose, baby? And she said, because if I lose, I have to read your book. So that's her attitude towards my
It's a punishment.
I knew I was writing it for sort of ads. I mean, it's for everyone. All the stuff that I ever write kind of just, you know, I always think I'm writing to women my age, but so many sort of younger women and teenage girls sort of seem to love what I write as well, which is amazing. But so I sort of, I had in my mind that I was sort of writing to a teenage girl while I was writing this. And then I only realized when I finished it that the teenage girl I was writing it to was myself when I was a teenager. And basically everything that I should have known when I was 14 and started going out in the world, I sort of put in the book and made happen to Johanna so that if there was some way of teleporting this novel back into my past, I wouldn't have spent the years between 14 and 18 making so many cataclysmic mistakes.
What kind of things were you reading at that age?
Oh, God, what did I love? I mean, I loved mainly 19th century fiction because kind of all the stuff that was sort of written for teenagers sort of in the 1980s when I was growing up was all about kind of beautiful girls going down the mall and kind of, you know, fancy boys called Brad. It was all that kind of Sweet Valley High stuff. And I lived in a really big, poor family on kind of in social housing. And I loved wearing long dresses. And so the books that, you know, the heroines whose stories spoke to me were like Jo March in Little Women or Jane Eyre in Jane Eyre. Kind of these working class girls who were kind of, you know, have to sort of fight their way sort of through the class system and try and triumph. They made a huge amount of more sense to me than some girl called Jennifer in Sweet Valley High.
How much is class a part of the novel?
Huge. I mean, I'm still trying to work out how it works in America. I mean, class basically equates to money and power and, you know, sort of, you know, and access to having your voice heard. And, you know, I know certainly in the UK there is a massive, you know, it's not even an underclass, it's the majority of the people in this country do not have their voices heard. They're not heard in newspapers. There was a study recently, something like 97% of kind of big stories in our broadsheets were written by straight, white, Oxbridge-educated men. Same with our big BBC radio shows, kind of, and news shows on television. And, you know, and again, in drama, in art, in acting, in music, you know, the working classes over the last 20 years have just been kind of edged out of the media, and our voices aren't being heard.
That's why you're writing two columns a week.
Yes, well, I have the entire quota. I have all the columns that the working classes in Britain have, and it seems really odd to me that kind of, but you know, I write a sitcom, I do stand up, I write films, I write TV columns, and in all that time, in 20 years, in all those industries, I've only ever met two people who come from a roughly similar background to me. You know, our government is made up of, there are more boys who went to Eton, in our cabinet, in our coalition cabinet, than there are women or working class people. You know, that's just people who've gone to one single private school. So, you know, the odds are hugely stacked against you for having your voice heard in this country if you come from my kind of background.
You've just come back from the U.S. Did you find that American readers responded to the class aspect or could see a kind of American equivalent in that?
Yeah, no, they all understood kind of like, you know, voices not being heard. I mean, I guess they're kind of maybe sort of more of a parallel with race, with class is race there, you know, kind of again, kind of the voices that aren't being heard. But, you know, there was certainly an understanding of, you know, sort of like a huge swathe of voices that aren't heard, that aren't represented in popular culture, in fiction, on TV and in movies. So, yes, no, there was a lot of chin stroking. You're like, yeah, no, I get where she's coming from. I get where she's coming from.
We understand lack of empowerment. Did you think of the book as being feminist fiction?
Well, I mean, everything I do is feminist. You know, I kind of eat toast in a feminist way and put on my shoes in a feminist way and fall over in a feminist way and get drunk in a feminist way because I believe that women are equal to men, which is all that feminism means. And, you know, and so I'm very aware that kind of the kind of heroes that boys have in fiction, girls don't have. Like, for instance, it was very important for me to make Johanna in the book a loner. You know, so often girls in books kind of are all about defined about their friends, their best friends, their gangs.
Yes.
And we don't really have that kind of female loner that we have in, you know, female male, that male teenage loner that we have in fiction, you know, like your Holden Caulfields. So, you know, I wanted to show that, you know, being a girl alone isn't something to be scared of. You know, your friends will come to you eventually. But in the meantime, you can be your own best friend. You can construct yourself and have your adventures and just patiently wait to find other like-minded souls.
Such an important point. This is the first book in a trilogy.
Yes. Well, there's so many things that I sort of, I mean, the beautiful thing about constructing a character and showing it from the very beginning, I'm just, kind of everything I do is to try and sort of, you know, empower girls and give them kind of, I like useful books, books that sort of give you advice for your life and show you how to do things. I think any book that's worth its salt should be kind of, you know, your life experiences in that book so that someone else can learn from your life experiences. So I wanted, in the first book, we see how to build a girl. We see how a girl who comes from nothing and hasn't been well-parented, you know, and comes from the lowest social backgrounds and, you know, hasn't had a good education, mm-hmm. can construct herself from sheer force of will and creation and imagination. The second book's called How to Be Famous, which is about class and creativity and mental illness. And then the third book, which is called How to Change the World, will be the same characters but 20 years later. And it will be at the point where our heroine, Johanna, will be forming her own political party. So that by the time you've read those books, you will go, I know how, you know, I want girls to read it to go, I know how I could form my own political party. I know how I could change this country. I know how I could draft legislation. Because that was a sense that, again, the working classes in our country had 100 years ago when we were forming the trade unions movement and forming the Labour Party. But now people don't, it isn't even in people's minds that they could ever do that, that we could have that sense of change and revolution that came so naturally to people 100 years ago when we didn't even have social media or these forms of communication we've got now. So I want to kind of resurrect that feeling that change could be very close and could be very near, and you could be the person who brought it about.
Well, let's end on that inspirational note. Thank you so much, Catelyn.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much, darling.
The novel, again, is How to Build a Girl by Catelyn Moran. John Williams joins me now to talk about what's going on in the book world. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
Nobel Prize.
Well, this morning, as we record this at least, one author is very happy, the recipient of not only the Nobel Prize, but the $1.1 million that it comes with, and that is Patrick Modiano, a French writer who's 69 years old, who was born in Paris soon after the end of World War II, and fairly little known in America and actually much of the world, I think, outside of France. Even the Swedish Academy that announced the award admitted that he was not very well known among even widely read people outside of France.
He is very big in France, though.
Yes, exactly. He's very well known in his home country. I'll leave all of the pronunciations in this segment up to you. You've got the lovely French accent. He had several novels published in English in the 70s and 80s, but most of those have fallen out of print. And now there are, I think, two novels for adults available in English and maybe one book for children.
What are the two grown-up books in English?
One of them is Missing Person, which is probably his best-known novel. He won the Prix Goncourt, France's most prestigious literary award for that, in 1978. It's about a detective who loses his memory and tries to piece together the rest of his life. And there is also a famous film by Louis Malle that was released in 1974 that you've seen, and I'll leave that title up to you.
La Combe Lucien.
Yes. And is that something worth seeking out?
It is worth seeking out. It's a fairly disturbing movie about a French teenager who tries to join the French resistance during World War II, during the occupation, and has a bad experience trying to get in. I think they think he's too young, and the person running it is a school teacher who he doesn't like, or he doesn't like him. And he kind of cavalierly joins with the Vichy occupation instead, and quite a brutal regime that he then enters into.
Oh, wow. Yeah, a lot of Modiano's work is based in Nazi-occupied France and deals with issues of memory and identity, and obviously politics, which the Swedish Academy has been known to privilege when making the announcement of the award. The Times, looking back, I always try to see, last year it was very easy with Alice Munro because we've obviously extensively covered her work. I looked back in the archives to see if we had anything about Modiano's work, and it's funny, the only two prominent things I could find, 1971, there was a very brief review of a novel of his called Night Rounds, and it was an unsigned review that called the book a frappe of cinema cliches. So that was not very positive. And then Roger Shattuck wrote a rather lengthy essay in 1981 for the Book Review about the state of French literature and poetry. And there was one sentence that involved Modiano, and it was, "There are still many readers in France who claim to admire most in a novelist a clear and supple style. Their current favorite, Patrick Modiano, uses situations and a style for which the most precise word I can find is wan." So he was not overly impressed either, but I think that for people interested, I think Missing Person would definitely be the place to start. It's available, and I think it's widely admired, and all his books are relatively short, so you can catch up without too much time investment.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Katha Pollitt joins me now. She is a poet, essayist, and columnist for The Nation, and her new book is Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Hi, Katha.
Hi, Pamela.
Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I think I decided to write this book because things have just gone too far in the wrong direction. We are seeing anti-abortion successes from one end of the country to the other. The state legislatures have passed, you know, dozens and dozens of new regulations, and abortion clinics are closing all over the country in many states.
There was just recently, of course, Texas.
Yes, Texas went from, you know, around 40 clinics to 7 or 8 overnight.
You write about women having the moral right to an abortion. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I think that the basic view of the anti-choice movement is that a woman who has sex should be ready to have a baby in 9 months, that motherhood is the default position of being a woman, and that motherhood is something that, you know, that a 12-year-old can do. There is just no situation in which a woman can have an interest in herself or aims or ambitions or look at her life and see what's rational for her that matters. And I think that abortion is the way that women for really thousands of years have used to have children when they can take care of those children. And I think that's a very moral thing to do.
When we talk about abortion in this country, we often talk about, you know, pre-Roe v. Wade and post-Roe v. Wade, but there's a longer history there. Do you think that part of the problem is that there's a kind of historical amnesia about the way in which abortion has played a role in women's lives for a long time?
Yes, I do. I think that a lot of people think, oh, well, before Roe v. Wade, there was no abortion, and now there's lots, and the world is going to hell. But in fact, there has always been abortion. There was abortion in medieval Catholic Italy. There was abortion in little villages in Africa where no one's heard of feminism. There are abortions in the countries where it's illegal now, which is most of Latin America. And the abortion rate in some of those countries, like Brazil, for example, is higher than in the United States. The crucial thing for Americans to remember is that when this country was founded, and in most states until after the Civil War, abortion was legal. So that means abortion was legal in the American Revolution. Abortion was legal when George and Martha were living in Mount Vernon. Abortion was legal when the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution. If they had wanted to criminalize abortion, they could have done that, but they didn't.
Do you think that the way in which Roe v. Wade was argued, the foundations based on the right to privacy, has created a problematic argument for abortion?
Well, I think the privacy argument is a good argument, but I wish that it was joined with an equality argument.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court was given, you know, the option of deciding on the basis of equality, and it preferred privacy. So that's kind of a done deal. But I think that abortion is not only a matter of a woman's privacy; it's her life, it's her body. It's also socially essential for women's equality, that you just can't have a life in the modern world in which you have to have random children all the time.
Right.
It means women will lose out educationally. They'll have to marry people they don't want to, or stay married to people that they don't want to. It means that they're hampered at work. And it's not as though we do a lot for mothers in this country.
Let's say you're a social conservative. Is there a social, like an argument that would be appealing to a social conservative in favor of abortion?
I think there is. I think that the idea that people should plan their lives and be pretty rational about when and how many children they have, people, especially women, should not be hampered for life because they have sex with someone. To me, those are not particularly radical arguments.
Right. It's kind of a different interpretation of taking responsibility or personal responsibility.
Right. You know, people always say, oh, yeah, abortion is such an irresponsible thing to do. No, abortion is taking responsibility.
The pro-choice argument has often been abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Do you think that's the right way to position the argument in favor of abortion?
No, I don't. Safe and legal, definitely. The problem is rare, which implies that there's too much abortion now, when really we don't know what the right amount of abortion is. You know, there are many, many women who can't have abortions that they want because of the Hyde Amendment, which bans the federal government from paying for abortion under Medicaid. Most states have a version of that that prevents state Medicaid being used for that purpose, too. So there are a lot of people now who would like to have abortions who aren't able to have them. So maybe there's too few abortions. I don't think the thing is, are there, you know, what is the right number of abortions and how can we attain that number? I think the important thing is for women to be able to make a good decision for themselves. I would say that one way in which there's too much abortion is that there's too little birth control.
Right.
And there's too little sex education. That's an important piece of it. But you'll find the people who are against abortion also are not really big fans of birth control or realistic sex education either.
With an argument book like this, of course, there are those readers who are going to say, you know, yes, 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 and thank you for phrasing it so well. And that's kind of a built-in readership on your side. But what's the main message you have for an abortion opponent who picks up your book? What is it that you want to get through to that reader?
Well, you know, my book isn't really written for the hardline anti-abortion people, because I think those people are mostly operating under a different framework, a religious framework.
Right.
A framework that says, you know, women should be mothers and always having children. That's terribly, terribly important. And if you don't want to have children, don't have sex. I think a lot of those people are not reachable. My book is really written more for people who are kind of pro-choice, but they don't want to think about it. They don't want it to be totally banned. And I always want to mention that although we don't like to think of it that way, the aim of the anti-abortion movement really is to criminalize abortion under every circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of present little measures, you know, like, oh, let's just make clinics let's just close some clinics and,
right,
because we care so much about women's health, and let's just heap up a lot of restrictions. But really the aim is to ban abortion. And they're very, you know, the organizations are very frank about that. But I would say that there are a lot of people who don't want to ban abortion, but it gives them a bad feeling. They think that there's, you know, women are too careless and
right,
there's too much sex about and women just want to do what they want to do and this is wrong. And I would just hope to make those people think about where this is all going. You know, people have the illusion that there are sort of good abortions and bad abortions and you can keep the good ones, and this is all in quotes, right, scare quotes, keep the good abortions legal and get rid of the bad abortions. So that you could have abortion would be legal if you were raped or, you know, if it was incest or if you're going to die, stuff like that. But once it gets into, well, I have to drop out of school or I have to leave my job or I'm too poor, that's when the support falls off.
Right.
And those, unfortunately, are the reasons that most abortions take place. So I would hope that the book will make people think a little more about why they are so quick to dismiss those personal, social, and economic reasons as valid reasons to end a pregnancy.
It seems that individual abortion cases kind of exist on this scale from acceptable to unacceptable, and that the one that people often think of first is the, you know, the 20-something who's maybe a little bit too young and maybe has a boyfriend but isn't yet married, and she gets an abortion. And it seems that both the pro-choice people agree that that's an acceptable reason to have an abortion, and the anti-choice contingent believes that's exactly the person who shouldn't be having an abortion. One of the more complex cases seems to be mothers who have abortions. It seems to kind of make people uncomfortable on either side of the divide. Why is that?
I guess I don't see that makes pro-choice people uncomfortable. But, you know, a fascinating and little discussed and little known fact is that 60% of women who have abortions already have children. And what this tells you is that the picture we have of who has an abortion, which is the teenage slut and the cold-hearted career woman, are really terribly misguided.
Mm-hmm.
And it also tells you that all this stuff about, you know, these state-mandated scripts that doctors now have to read women about fetal development and forcing women to have unnecessary ultrasounds and describing what's on the screen or even making them see it. You know, these women have already given birth. They have already seen ultrasounds. They have already been pregnant, and they know what's going on. It's part of this picture that women who have abortions don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're confused. They're being pushed into it by someone else. They don't realize. This is the anti-abortion picture now of the woman who has an abortion. It used to be she's an evil slut. Now it's more often she's confused, and that's why she needs us to prevent her from doing this. Basically.
This is a very paternalistic view of women's healthcare choices. You have a chapter in the book on the 6 myths of abortion. We've probably touched on those in this, but what are one or two of the other popular myths?
Opponents of abortion who are disproportionately very religious, either Catholic or evangelical fundamentalist Protestants, talk about abortion as if it's banned in the Bible. In fact, the Bible does not mention abortion, and all the claims that it does involve extrapolation from things that are really about something else, like where the psalmist says, you know, before, you know, you knew me when I was in my mother's womb.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's poetry. That's a metaphor. That doesn't mean don't abort me.
Right.
You know? And under Jewish law, and the Jews really ought to know what's in the Old Testament since they wrote it, you become a person when you draw your first breath. You are not a person in the womb. You are not a person as a fertilized egg or an embryo that's the size of a pea. So I think that, you know, the other side, the abortion opponents have managed to Shanghai God into this in a way that's very unfair. And you know what's interesting? In the 60s, when abortion was still illegal, but people were becoming more conscious of how unfair that was and thinking about ways of liberalizing the law. And many, many religious denominations issued statements saying, we think the law needs to be liberalized. And one of those denominations was the Southern Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that, you know, if you're a Southern Baptist, you have to be completely anti-abortion, that's a new thing.
You've written a number of books that have been really collections of essays on a wide-ranging topics. In this book, you're offering a single, albeit multifaceted, argument. Just in terms of constructing that and thinking about it, how different a project was it for you to write this kind of book?
Oh, it was much harder. You know, you put together a collection over years, and each piece is of a fairly short length. And writing a book that has a kind of a through argument is much more difficult. And I complain bitterly the whole time to all my friends.
Well, it certainly couldn't be more timely. I guess, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, there's always something new going on with abortion rights in this country. Katha Pollitt, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Pamela.
The book again is Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights by Katha Pollitt. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Before I tell you what's new on the list, and there are some things, there are a couple of trends that I wanted to mention. While the new Nobel laureate Patrick Modiano is not yet a bestseller, it is a good time for literary prizes, with three of the National Book Award contenders sharing space on the hardcover fiction list this week.
Who are they?
Those three are Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See, at number 5 after 22 weeks. Emily St. John Mandel's smart dystopian novel Station 11 enters the list at number 15. That's on the National Book Award long list too. And John Darnielle's Wolf in White Van, which is at number 16 in its second week. You also have the reigning Pulitzer winner, that's Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch, of course, at number 12 after almost a year on the list. It's at 50 weeks. And a bunch of quality fiction from non-American authors, too. Ian McEwan's The Children Act is number 6 in its 4th week. David Mitchell's The Bone Clocks is number 7 in its 5th week. Sarah Waters' The Paying Guests is number 9 in its 3rd week.
Many a Brit.
They're all British, yes. While the Japanese Haruki Murakami has fallen off the list with his latest novel, Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki and His Years of Pilgrimage, but it is hanging on to the extended list at number 18.
And he was one of the favorites for the Nobel.
Passed over yet again.
All right. He joins Philip Roth.
Yeah. Now, besides Emily St. John Mandel, there are some other newcomers to the hardcover fiction list. None of them prize winners, as far as I know, but they are Garth Stein with A Sudden Light, new at number 14. Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison have a book called The Lost Key. That's new at number 8. And not a prize winner, but a record holder, James Patterson, with his co-writer Michael Ledwidge, are new at number 1 with a book called Burn. In nonfiction, the trend seems to be TV tie-ins. Not only is The Roosevelts still on the list, that's the Jeffrey Ward and Ken Burns companion volume to the PBS series, which it's at number 13 after 4 weeks, but also Steven Johnson's new book, How We Got to Now, which is also the companion volume to a PBS series, and it enters the hardcover list at number 4. So there seems to be a whole nefarious public TV big publishing industrial complex going on right now. There are 3 other new titles in nonfiction. Rebel Yell by the historian S.C. Gwynne is new at number 10.
That's about Stonewall Jackson?
Yes, it is. Then at number 5, Steven Pinker, the Harvard psychologist, has a book called The Sense of Style. And then at number 2, bringing it all back to TV again, Lena Dunham, the creator and star of Girls on HBO, has an essay collection called Not That Kind of Girl.
Reviewed this week in the book review by Sloan Crosley. All right. Thanks so much, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.